start off with the onager. Can anyone tell me what an onager is? Right up on the screen. See the word? Tell me what an onager is. No Googling allowed. Nobody knows? One second, I'm getting my notes ready. Okay, I'll give you the Hebrew name, the name that's used in Tanakh. Actually, in Tanakh, it has two names. It has Arod and Terah. Arod or the Terah. Anyone know yet? Wild donkey. Very good, Daniel. But not just any old wild donkey. A wild donkey just conjures up the idea of a donkey running wild. But an onager is something a little bit more complicated than that. Let me see if I can find a picture to share with you. Sort my archives. No, I don't have any. Let's see if this one works. Here we go. There we go. Here is an onager. Now, what you have to realize here is that there are actually two types of wild donkey. There is the African wild ass and the Asiatic wild ass. Okay? And the Asiatic wild ass used to be found in Israel. They actually became extinct in Israel in the last century. They're now trying to breed them again and set them loose in the wild in a reserve called Chaibar. It's in the Negev, just north of Eilat. They're trying to breed onagers in big enough numbers to let them loose again. They've only let a few loose in the Negev. There's now about 100 roaming around the Negev, and they're hoping to still release more. Okay. Now we'll get to the difference between the African and the Asiatic wild ass soon. Let's just start with some mentions of it. Esav, right? Sorry, not Esav. Yishmael. Yishmael is called, and it's said that he's going to be an onager. Here, the angel of God said to her, "Behold, you are pregnant, you shall give birth to a son, and you shall call him by the name Yishmael, for God has heard your suffering. And he shall be a Pereh man." Yeah, it says, Pereh Adam. His hand shall be against everyone, and everyone's hand shall be against him, and he shall dwell in the face of all his brothers. So, you know, this phrase, Pereh Adam, some translate it as a wild man, but it really means a wild ass of a man. He's going to be an onager of a man. The commentary is, there's a bit of a difference of opinion as to what Pereh means. Some say it means wilderness in general. Some say it means wild creatures in general. But Targum Yerushalmi and Sepharno says that the Pereh is it's the onager. Same word that Pereh means elsewhere in Tanakh. It's the Arod, which is the wild ass. Now, where you have a lot of mentions of the Pereh in Tanakh is with the book of Eov. So, let's have a look. You know, Eov complains to God about all the hardships he suffered. And sorry, going out of order here. Just before we get to Eov, let's go have another reference which will help us understand Eov better, and that's with when Daniel is describing to Belshazzar the fate of Nebuchadnezzar, right? Because Nebuchadnezzar degenerated from man to beast. So let's look how this is described here. One second. My mouse is frozen up. Here we go. Yeah, it says, "And he was driven from the sons of men, and his heart was made like the beasts, and his dwelling was with the onagers. They fed him with grass like an ox, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, until he learned that the Most High God ruled in the kingdom of men, and he appoints over it whom he will." Right, so here it says that the Nebuchadnezzar degenerated into total wildness. It says that he dwelt with the onagers. Right, so here again, the idea of it representing a very wild animal. Which may seem odd. You know, you think of wild animals, you think of lions, I don't know, leopards, wolves. You don't normally think of You know, you don't think of donkeys. So we have to understand this a little bit better. So now let's go back to Eov. And let's look at what God's speech to Eov where he mentions the onager. Okay, so God says as follows, who has sent out the wild ass free? Who has loosed the bands of the onager? I translated it that way because, you know, one place it says Arod, one place it mentions Perah. But, you know, it's basically two synonyms for the same thing. The onager, the wild ass. Right, to him I have given the wilderness for his home and the barren land for his dwelling. He scorns the tumult of the city, nor does he regard the shouts of the driver. The range of the mountains is his pasture, and he searches after every green thing. So, to understand here what the onager is doing here, we have to understand the whole context of Eov. Right, Eov is the, well, we discussed this earlier in the class we had on hippos. Right, Eov is ecstatic, and he's undergoing terrible suffering, and he says to God, how could you do this to me? And what God's answer basically is, is who are you to expect to understand all of my ways? I'm God, the infinite, all-powerful, almighty, creator of the entire universe, and you're just a human being. So God describes all these phenomena from nature in order to humble Eov, in order to make him realize his limitations. Right, so we mentioned the hippopotamus, right, the gigantic size and power of the mighty behemoth that humbles Eov. And here's another aspect of humbling man, of making man realize that he's not, he shouldn't expect to understand everything in the universe. And that's the idea of the wildness of the onager. Now let's get back, in order to understand this, let's get back to mentioning that there's the African wild ass and the Asiatic wild ass. So, you know, it doesn't sound very, so there's a huge difference there. African and Asian, what's the difference? But the truth is there's a huge difference. The domestic donkey is domesticated from the African wild ass. And the domestic donkey, is, you know, not only is it domesticated, but it is the most menial animal. Right? It's just, when you think of a donkey, you think of something that's totally subservient, you know, drooping head, trudging along after its owner. Right? A donkey is always the idea of something very menial, something incredibly subservient. And even the idea of the name for donkey, even chamor, like chomer, you know, just raw material, right? Raw material that can be bended to your will. That's the idea of the donkey. Right? The donkey is total subservience. Right? And the domestic donkey is domesticated from the African wild ass. Now, the Asiatic wild ass, which is the onager, superficially it looks extremely similar to the African wild ass. You have to be a real pro in order to be able to tell them apart. But, unlike its African cousin, the Asiatic wild ass, the onager, is the one you have in Israel, it cannot be domesticated. It can't. It's just too wild of an animal. Let me get this sentence here about, one second, I can't find them here. Got a quote here. I'm trying to find this quote from this zoologist. Second. Here we go. Tristram. Right, Henry Tristram, he was an explorer who set out to study the nature of Israel in about the 1870s. And you know, he traveled the length and breadth of Israel, and he wrote a book about the nature of the Holy Land, very interesting book. And he mentions the onager. And he says as follows. He writes, I saw a wild ass in the oasis of Suf, which had been snared when a colt. Though it had been kept for 3 years in confinement, it was as intractable as when first caught, biting and kicking furiously at everyone who approached it, and never enduring a saddle on its back. In appearance and color, it could not have been distinguished from one of the finest specimens of the tame ass. Right, so here you have the idea that the onager is something that looks superficially similar to the African wild ass, which has been domesticated as a donkey, but it just can't be tamed. It cannot be tamed. So it's the idea that it's wildness, you know, I mean, you know, there's lots of wild animals. Lions are wild. Leopards are wild. But the wildness of the onager is significant because it's in a creature that looks so much like a donkey, which is the most subservient of all animals. That's why the wildness of the Onager is so, you know, it stands out so much. It's so striking. So that's why, you know, the Onager, as opposed to things such as the lion or the leopard, is often used as the metaphor for wildness. Because there, it's, you know, lions, well, of course it's wild, you know, it's a big thing with sharp teeth. But something that looks so much like the donkey, the ultimate homer, the ultimate tractable animal, so it's very striking that an Onager is so wild. So that's why it's used as the metaphor for extreme wildness. And so then we can understand what's going on here in Eov, where, you know, God is trying to humble Eov to make him realize that who are you, you know, a mortal human, to expect to understand the ways of the world. Right? So, you know, people tend to be arrogant to think that I should understand what's going on, I should be able to get to grips with what's going on. So God is humbling Eov. So he speaks about the Onager, right? That this creature, which, you know, looks so similar to the African wild ass that you can domesticate, but look, but it's free, it's a wild animal. Right? I've given him the wilderness for his home. He scorns the tumult of the city. He does not regard the shouts of the driver. Right? The idea, he can't be domesticated. Now, don't think you're so powerful that you can bend nature to your whim. You can't even domesticate this thing that looks so much like a donkey. So another aspect of God trying to convey humility to Eov. And again, and understanding this wildness, we can understand more now why the idea of Ace of Yishmael being called Per Adam, a wild ass of a man, an onager of a man, the idea of wildness, the idea that won't you know, look similar to other things, but won't accept law and order being imposed upon it. It's going to be wild. Another interesting idea here that I want to mention. Interesting pasuk in Yirmiyah. Let's see if I can cut and paste here. Yeah, I wonder if I can get the Hebrew in here. Let me see if I can cut and paste the Hebrew into this window. I think it might go in backwards, but let's see. The words here are reversed. The Hebrew words are reversed here. Okay, you are like a wild ass used to the wilderness, sucking in the wind from its desire. Who can reform its instinct? Right, the idea. So there again, you have the idea that who can reform its instinct, you know, who is going to control it. But there's another interesting phrase here, that it's sucking in the wind. Right, sucking in the wind. And, you know, an odd phrase. Here's elsewhere in Yirmiyah. Just remove the Hebrew here because it's not displaying properly. And we'll paste in the next pasuk. The wild asses stand in the high hills. They suck in the wind like jackals. Sha'afu. Right, so here's two accounts of the Onager sucking in the wind. Now, what's that going about? Now, what's that saying? So, you had the idea about horses laughing. Right? People speak about horses laughing. Now, horses don't laugh, but they do something that looks very much like laughing, which is that they kind of open their mouths and kind of curl up the upper lip. Like this. Yeah, but you've never seen a rabbi do that in a lecture. That's what all members of the horse family do. It's very noticeable in the Onagers. And what they're doing when they do that is they're sucking in the wind, like the pasuk says, and they're sucking it over the roof of their mouth. Because inside the mouth, they have a very active Jacobson's organ. Now, a Jacobson's organ is something that all animals have. Just in some animals, and people have it too. Just it's more active in some species and then others. It's basically a kind of sense taste organ. In humans, it's not very active at all, except with pregnant women. Right? Women who are pregnant have this incredibly powerful sense of smell, and that's because their Jacobson's organ has been very strong. And horses, things in the horse family, they're also a very powerful Jacobson's organ. It's on the bridge of the mouth, so in order to make the best use of it, they have to pull in the air over it. So that's the idea of sucking in the wind. And they do it. The reason why they're doing it is they're trying to trap, one reason is they're trying to trap pheromones from the females. Right, so it's a tool of desire. So this idea of the Onager sucking in the wind, right, means it's pulling in the air over its Jacobson's organ, smelling out the females, and it's also a symbol of the wildness of it. Okay? So that's everything you ever wanted to know about Onagers. Alright, now we're going to move on to a different creature. Because I have a couple of creatures here in my office, and I wanted to show you all of them and talk about them. So I already showed you my gecko and my sandfish. I have another creature in the cage next to me, which is something that plays a prominent role in the Midrash. And I'm keeping it. I have a wine cooler in here, because, you know, one of these like little plug-in refrigerator things, because it's a creature that needs to be kept cool. It gets to be over 65 degrees Fahrenheit, starts to be extremely unhappy. It gets to 75 degrees Fahrenheit, pretty much dies very soon. Anyone want to guess what it is? You can start off by guessing what order of animals it must be in, if it doesn't like being, if it can't take being warm. Animals are reptile, and reptiles love to be warm. Reptiles, the warmer the better. Any other guesses? It is an amphibian, and specific type of amphibian is, see the camera here, yeah, see that? Okay, what is it? Yep, it is a salamander. Yeah. What kind of salamander is it? Extra points for Sakia. Close. It is a fire salamander. Now, it's called a fire salamander for two reasons. Number one is the fiery pattern on its back. Number two is because of the legend about its origins in fire. Okay, so let me just put them down somewhere for a second. Receptacle to put them in. No, I'll stick it back in the cage. Let's first take a look at what the Gemara has to tell us about the salamander. Let's start with this. Let's start with... Yeah. Let's start with the story of Chizkiah, Gemara in Sanhedrin. List it up here. Okay, with Chizkiah, king of Yehuda. Oh, it's talking about how there was an ancient... pagan rite of putting your kids in the fire. And it says, also with Chizkiah, king of Yehuda, his father sought to do so. His mother smeared him with salamandra. So what does it mean that she smeared him with salamandra? So the Midrash Tanchuma provides an explanation as follows. Listed in. There are creatures that thrive in fire and not in air, such as the salamandra. How so? When glassmakers heat the furnace for 7 consecutive days and nights, out of the thick of the flames emerges a creature that resembles a spider, or in other texts it says a mouse, which people call salamandra. If a person smears his hand with its blood, or any other of his limbs, fire has no power over that part of him, because the beginning of the salamandra's development is from fire. Right? The idea is that it's generated from fire, and therefore its blood has fireproof qualities. See that described elsewhere in the Gemara in Chulin. Right? The rabbi said the Sab according to its kind. Right? That's in the list of Shuratzim and Vermin in the Torah. It says it includes the Arafat and the Nephilim and the Salamandra. And when Rabbi Akiva would reach this verse, he would say, how diverse are your works, O God? You have creatures that grow in the fire, and you have creatures that grow in the air. Those which grow in the fire would die instantly if exposed to air. Right? So it's talking about the Salamandra as the creature that grows in the fire. Right, and right, you burn a fire for a long time, and then salamander comes out of it. And because it's generated in fire, its blood has fireproof characteristics. Now, obviously, that's something that strikes us as being slightly odd. Right? And, you know, it's, right, this is something that, one second, let me just, mention else. The salamander was also known for being, poisonous, right, for being very, very poisonous. Now, how do we know that the salamander they're talking about is the salamander I just showed you? Well, first, you know, the fact that it's called a salamander is an indication, not conclusive proof, but an indication. But aside from that, the salamander I just showed you is also a creature that historically was always believed to be generated from fire. So, since that salamander I showed you was historically believed to be generated from fire, then, and the Gemara speaks about the salamander as something generated from fire, presumably it's the same creature. And I'm going to, later on, we're going to give another reason as to why it must be the same creature. Another reason would be that the idea of the salamander being poisonous, so salamanders are poisonous. They secrete poison on their skin. That's why I must be very careful to wash my hands before I eat anything or touch anything with my hands. You know what? Let me just go and do that now quickly in case I forget, because it's, I really don't want to get salamander venom in it. So you know, just like the legend, salamander of legend was had this venom. It's true, the salamanders today, the fire salamanders do have venom in their skin. Right, it's just dangerous if you ingest it. In my zoology books over here in the shelves, so a lot of them speak about salamanders and they speak about ancient legends of salamanders, and they say that there are, you know, this belief about the salamander being generated from fire. Say it has two. Say the origin of this belief is that salamanders they hibernate in logs, right? And when you put this log, you know, you're building a fire. You take a log, you throw it in the fire, so the salamander crawls out from the log because it wants to escape to safety. And people who were burning the fire, they would think that the salamander is actually being generated by the fire itself. So that, you know, together with the fiery appearance of its skin. Well, let me try and upload a photo of a salamander. So the idea of the salamander emerging from the bonfire, in combination with the fiery experience of the fiery appearance of its skin, that's what led people to believe that salamanders are actually generated from fire, and in turn that they have fireproof qualities. Okay. Just upload a picture here, and they say that of course this isn't true. Oops. Because the salamander is an amphibian, and amphibians need cool conditions. Like I said, I have to keep my salamanders in a wine cooler, because if they're kept too warm, they just they basically shrivel up and die. You know, amphibians usually need to be kept cool. They respirate through their skin needs to be moist. So amphibians they die in dry air. They can only live in moist conditions. So the books say, there we go, here's a beautiful picture of a salamander on the screen. You can see the poison glands. Just show the pointer here. Here are the main poison glands. You see the lumps behind the head with these black dots. Right? The poison is exuded from those black dots. Right? Toads also have it, but in salamanders it's certainly particularly toxic. So they say, you know, that's where the myth came from. But they say that it's just a myth. The question is, you know, is it just a myth or not? So there's a few things to note here. What does the Gemara tell us here? The Gemara tells us that Chizkiah's mother smeared his skin with salamander. The Midrash of the Gemara says that salamanders, these creatures, grow in fire. Now, it's certainly the idea of a creature being generated from fire certainly goes against everything we know from zoology. Right, everything we know of science tells us that fire does not generate creatures. What about the idea of smearing somebody with salamander and rendering them fireproof? So there's some other texts which discuss this idea in a little bit more detail. Here's one interesting one, which is a bit sidetracking a little bit, but still interesting. This is Anaf Yosef, which is a commentary in the Midrash. Says as follows. It says that the fires of Gehinnom have no power over a Torah scholar, like a garment made out of the wool of the salamander, which is impossible to clean other than with fire. Garment made out of salamander wool. You clean it with fire, and the garment doesn't get burnt, but any dirt gets burnt. So what's he talking about there? What's salamander wool? Now, salamander wool was actually a substance that you could buy in the Middle Ages. And if people thought it came from salamanders, and therefore salamanders in medieval texts were often drawn as being furry. Right, and that might be the idea of the Midrash saying that it's a salamander looks like a mouse. Because salamanders were sometimes drawn as being lizardish, looking like the salamander here, but with tufts of fur coming out of them. What was this salamander wool that people were buying? It was actually asbestos. Right? Asbestos, which is a fibrous mineral, was originally made in China, or excavated in China, and it was passed on to the Western world as being salamander wool. So that's not going to help us here. There's something else going on here. Let's look at what the Ramban says here. The Ramban about Chizkiah being smeared with salamander. You don't smear somebody with wool. So what exactly was he being smeared with? So the Midrash says it was the blood of the salamander. Now look at how Ramban says it. A rabbi stated that with Chizkiah, King of Yehuda, his father sought to burn him in fire, but his mother smeared him with the oil of a salamander. And so here, blood has changed to oil. And that alerts us to the fact that we're not necessarily talking about blood here, we're talking about a bodily fluid. Right? The truth is that dam doesn't necessarily always need to mean blood, it can refer to bodily fluids, likewise oil. So we're not necessarily talking about the blood of a salamander. But could there be some kind of bodily fluid in salamanders that has fire-resistant qualities? So I came across. So there's a report. There's a report from 300 years ago, which says as follows. I don't remember how on earth I found this, but it says as follows. Let's paste it in here. Okay, this is from the Philosophical Transactions, in the 1666 edition. Here's a letter written from Rome. This came from that expert anatomist M. Stino to Dr. Kuhn Videl, that a knight called Corvini had assured him that, having cast a salamander, brought him out of the Indies into the fire, the animal thereupon swelled presently, and then vomited store of thick slimy matter which did put out the neighbouring coals, for which the salamander retired immediately, putting them out again in the same manner as soon as they rekindled, and that by this means saving himself from the force of the fire, for the space of 2 hours. The gentleman above mentioned being then unwilling to hazard the creature any further. Okay, so this is, a second-hand account from 300 years ago. So we're not going to take it as being absolute scientific proof. But, here there's something interesting. Here there's a person who claims to have seen a salamander living in fire by virtue of, excreting, and here it says vomiting up, a certain type of slimy matter that put the fire out. Now then you have Thomas Bulfinch, who was writing about a century ago. He writes as follows. The foundation of the fables is supposed to be the fact that the salamander really does secrete from the pores of his body a milky juice, which when he is irritated is produced in considerable quantity, and would doubtless for a few moments defend the body from fire. Then it is a hibernating animal, and in winter retires to some hollow tree or other cavity, where it coils itself up and remains in a torpid state till the spring again calls it forth. May therefore sometimes be carried with the fuel to the fire, and wake up only time enough to put forth all its faculties for its defense. Its viscous juice would do good service, and all who profess to have seen it acknowledge that it got out of the fire as fast as its legs could carry it. Indeed, too fast for them ever to make prize of one, except in one instance, and in that one the animal's feet and some parts of its body were badly burnt. Now, again, I have a situation where nowadays all my zoology books speak about this whole idea of the salamander being fireproof as being just myth, but there's some historical sources here that mention it. And I did come across a contemporary account that mentions it. This was by a zoologist called Mark Stromberg, who was at the University of California, who was not studying salamanders. He was studying in general the effects of forest fires. But when he was doing a forest fire, he was deliberately setting a forest fire, he noticed something very interesting about salamanders, which he published in the Herpetological Review, and he sent me his complete notes. And I checked up on him, and Mark Stromberg is known to be a very careful, methodical scientist. Look what he writes. On April 10th, 1996, we ignited a prescribed burn on a chemise stand on the upper steep south-facing side of School Hill in the Hastings Reserve, Carmel Valley, California. One large live oak in a southwest exposure had a large accumulation of dead leaves that had accumulated in a semicircle on the ground below the canopy. This tree is about 100 meters from the nearest surface water in Robertson Creek. This depth is from 10 to 20 centimeters, and probably this affords dry season refuge for newts. Newts and salamanders are all in the same family. We ran a drip torch along the vegetation 5-10 meters below the tree at about 2 p.m. Soil, vegetation, and relative humidities were high, and we only had a partial ignition with scattered slow patches of fire. Blah, 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 blah. Skip a few lines. Standing at the uphill side of the circle, I moved down along the semicircle of burning oak litter with a shovel, putting out the flames. I noticed a pair of newts, Erica terosa, moving over the unburned litter. They were walking downhill along a line between the trunk of the tree and the bottom of the semicircular front of the fire burning uphill. They were both shiny and wet and moving as fast as I have ever seen a newt walk, which is not very. Generally, these newts only move above ground here during wet nights or evenings before storms. When they are moving in the dry habitat, the skin is dry. That they were shiny with skin secretions was striking. I stopped moving and watched the newts from about 5 meters. Each newt walked directly into the flame front and did not pause while walking through the burning leaves. Their slime foamed up, resembling an egg meringue. Within 20 to 30 seconds, they were through the fire and in the cool black ashes of the litter. I picked one up and looked at the skin, the crusty white coating wiped off easily from their wet bodies. I have handled hundreds of newts in an ongoing study of amphibian populations at Hastings. I did not see any blisters. The skin color looked normal. I put the individual back in the forest litter and it continued to walk downhill. It did not stop or curl up, but walked normally, still walking at near record newt speeds. As they walked through patches of unburned grass, the leaves and litter removed almost all the thin white crust. They walked under a rotting lug in dense litter and I did not follow them further. In our ongoing study and others, newts have walked several miles from breeding ponds after breeding through such oak woodlands. I assume that they were widely scattered and refuged in the oak woodland during the dry season, but we only rarely find them under logs in shady forest floor during the summers. Fires were frequent in central coastal California, where these newts are common. Foaming of the skin secretions would certainly help dissipate heat of evaporation and maybe a mechanism used by these newts to escape wildland fire. So this is, you know, an incredible phenomenon. Salamanders and newts have all kinds of glands in their body secreting various fluids. Because they're amphibians and they respirate in part through their skin, so the skin has to be kept moist. So they moisten their skin by secreting various fluids. I mean, people say that reptiles are slimy. It's not true. Reptiles are not slimy at all. They have dry skin. But amphibians, like frogs, toads, newts, salamanders, are slimy. They have to be slimy so they can breathe. So they have glands that produce slime in their skin. And they also have glands that produce poison, pheromones to attract their mates and so on. So I don't know which glands are responsible, but whichever glands it is, when they go through fire, they produce this slime that foams up to resemble an egg meringue, renders them fireproof. So I think there's 2 points to stress here. Number one is that, you know, you have something, you know, this legend of the salamander being generated in fire, possessing fireproof characteristics, fireproof fluids, which is just completely dismissed in most zoology books. Why? Because, you know, certainly one part of it is obviously false, the idea about them being born in fire. And once you have an old belief, which one part of it is partly false, so people have a tendency to just dismiss the whole thing. But you see that, in fact, it shouldn't all be dismissed. There is a kernel of truth to it. The salamanders possess this extraordinary ability, you know, which I don't know of any other creature that possesses this ability, to actually survive in fire by virtue of this incredible technique of making a foam around them. So there's a lesson to be learnt here about, you know, not necessarily swallowing everything you read in the science book, that sometimes people will dismiss things without sufficient reason. And simultaneously, we can also be amazed here at this extraordinary ability of the fire. So, you know, upwards we had, what did we have? We had Rabbi Akiva saying that when he came across a pasuk which included salamanders, he'd say, Marabu Masecho Hashem, your creatures are so diverse. So he was saying it with regard to his belief that salamanders grow in fire. Okay, we know that salamanders don't grow in fire, but we can still say that you have a creature, an amphibian no less, right? Normally something that doesn't do well in dry heat, but for short periods it can actually survive, not just in dry heat, but in an actual fire, in flames, by producing a fire retardant foam. So certainly something about which we can say, Marabu Masecho Hashem. Certainly an extraordinary characteristic of salamanders. And with regard to the idea of it being born in fire, okay, so we know that's not true, but you know, it's no reason to look down upon the sages for believing that. Because that was standard belief in those days. That's what the experts believed, that's what Aristotle believed, and so on. And it's understandable why the experts believed it, and that's what was in the zoology books. Right, so in the same way as what most people believe about salamanders is based on what they believe in the zoology books, which, you know, in some cases is not correct, right? The zoology books say that salamanders cannot live in fire, and they can live in fire for short periods. But back then, people believed what they read in the zoology books, and sometimes it wasn't correct. But there's no reason to look down on them for having certain incorrect beliefs. So that's the salamander. Any questions? Oh, Daniel wants to know if the poison is a neurotoxin, such that the nerve endings don't feel the pain of the fire. Don't know. Could be. All right. Let's move on to what will probably be our final creature for the evening. And that will be quail. Right. We discussed mammal. We discussed amphibians. So let's talk about a bird. Quails. The quails are famously mentioned in the Torah. I have quails too outside in my aviary, so it'll take a while to catch them, so I'm not going to take the time to do that now. Let's just get a picture of a quail up here so we know what we're talking about. I don't have a picture of a quail. Oh, one second, yes I do, 1 second. No, I don't. A picture of a quail. Okay. Quail is a small fat bird. Right. There's different types of quails. See, the quail that you may sometimes see in aviaries that usually... Oh, here we go. Here's a quail. Quails that you sometimes see in aviaries are Chinese quail, which are very, very small, very colorful, only about that big. Quail of the Torah is the Coturnix European quail. Here it is on the screen, which is about this big. And quails are famously mentioned in the Torah as the birds that the Jewish people ate in the wilderness. Let's cut and paste this in here. Go. There you go. Wind traveled from God and it swept quails from the sea. It sent an exhausted over the camp, a day's journey in each direction surrounding the camp, at around 2 cubits over the face of the ground. The people arose all that day, all night, and all next day, and they gathered the quail. The one who gathered the least accumulated 10 bushels worth, and they spread them out around the camp. The meat was still between the teeth and not yet finished, and the anger of God was kindled in the people, and God smote them a very mighty blow. And he called that place by the name of the Graves of Craving, for there they buried the people that craved. Right? Bit of a strange story. Right? What's going on here? Now, what's the context before that? And the context before that is that Moshe is telling to God how the Jewish people are complaining that they want meat. And God says to Moshe, I'm going to give them meat. I'm going to give them meat for a whole month until they're sick of it, until it's coming out of their noses. And now Moshe said, well, can you really do that? Now, is it really possible to do that? And God says, well, is the hand of God short? You're doubting my ability? Yeah, I can certainly give them all this meat, but even until it's coming out of their noses. But it's very strange to understand, you know, why is Moshe doubting God's ability to do that? I mean, they've just seen God do the most incredible miracle, the 10 plagues, splitting of the sea. So, obviously they're aware that God is God, right? And certainly Moshe, right? Certainly Moshe Rabbeinu is aware that God can do anything. So what is Moshe Rabbeinu doing, saying, are you really going to be able to provide meat for the entire Jewish people? So the commentaries explain as follows, that it's not that Moshe didn't think that Hashem could do it, it's that he didn't think that Hashem could do it in a naturalistic way. And he understood that God was not about to be doing a miracle, that God was going to be doing it in a naturalistic way. Right, Ramban's reason for that is that, according to Ramban, miracles are either an act of... miracles are very black and white for Ramban. It's either an act of absolute compassion and salvation, or it's an act of terrible punishment for the wicked. But in this case, it wouldn't be either of those, right? It's not compassion and salvation, because the Jewish people really should have just been happy with what they had and not be complaining for more. And it wasn't, the whole thing wasn't a punishment for the wicked, because it was giving food for them to eat. So because it was kind of like an in-between kind of thing, Ramban felt that, you know, this is not what miracles are. Miracles are either, you know, all good salvation or all bad destruction. Not an in-between thing like this would not be a miracle. So Moshe understood that God, what God was saying was that he was going to provide meat for the entire people, but without doing a miracle. And that's what he was saying. He can't understand how that's possible. But God said it is possible, and he did it via quail. Now, what's so special about about quail? So as you see from this picture, quail are fat, right? They have stubby little wings. They are not the greatest flyers at all. Nevertheless, they have to go on a big migration every year. They have to migrate from Europe down to the warmer countries of Africa and so on. So you've got millions of birds who have to get from one place to another, and they fly. But because they're not great flyers, they fly very low down. And they also, they tend to, you know, choose a wind that's going to help them fly, carry them along. So they fly with the wind, and they fly low down, just about this high off the ground. So, and that's what the passage describes. A wind traveled from God, and it swept quails from the sea, and sent them down exhausted over the camp, a day's journey in each direction surrounding the camp, at around 2 cubits over the face of the ground. Right, so that's the right, that's exactly the height that the quails come in at. And they come in over the sea, over the Mediterranean, and they come in exhausted, as it says. And in recent years, what people in Egypt used to do to catch them is they just put nets along the edge of the beach. Well, it doesn't have to be that high, right? The nets just have to be about 5 feet tall. And they'd catch millions and millions of quails flying in over the Mediterranean. Right? You know, it was so easy to catch so many of them that the quails, you know, came very close to extinction. And now it's, you know, they have to make it illegal to do that, to trap quails in that way. But, but you know, this goes to show the density of how the quails do. Right? And that's how the passage describes it perfectly, about how the people could easily get them. They could just basically grab them out of the air. Right? Let's, Tristram, the guy that we mentioned earlier, who saw the spoke about the untamable wild ass. So he also describes in his explorations of Israel in the 19th century, he's about quail. He says, thus throughout the Mediterranean, the quails arrive at night in a similar state of exhaustion. I have myself found the ground in Algeria in the month of April covered with quails for an extent of many acres at daybreak, whereas on the preceding afternoon there had not been one. They were so fatigued that they scarcely moved till almost trodden upon. Although hundreds were slaughtered for 2 days, they did not leave the district till the wind veered. And exactly as the Torah describes. And, Now, Pliny, you know, in terms of the quantity of quails, right, so you see here he talks about the ground being covered with them. Right, Tristram here says the ground is covered with them. And the Pasuk, it says that they were in a day's journey in each direction surrounding the camp. Now, it may sound like an exaggeration, but quails do, you know, find in huge numbers. Right, Pliny the Elder, the Roman naturalist, he reported that quails would sometimes land in ships in such quantities, and they're exhausted, they'd have to seek refuge in ships, that the ships would sink from the weight of all the quail sitting on them. In the beginning of the 20th century, Egypt was exporting about 2 million quails a year. Right? Like I said, they were catching so many then, there's not many left, but they were talking about millions of birds at the time. And again, this thing about it being 2 cubits over the face of the ground, so the commentators have different interpretations. Some say it means that it was birds 2 cubits tall, and they thought that it was talking about storks. Right, others said it means that they were in heaps 2 cubits deep. But the Midrash says that it was a height of 2 cubits. Right, this is the Sifri. Right, the Sifri is pasted in here. They were flying and rising 2 cubits over the ground, so it should not be difficult to catch them. Right, and that's how quails fly. They fly very low over the ground, so you can grab them out of the air. In fact, I read a report that in the last century, you know, people in Egypt, they would just be like having coffee in the street, and they just keep nets with them, and they just reach out and capture quails out of the air. So this is how it was done. It was This is how God was able to provide meat for the nation via naturalistic means. And, you know, it's accurate in every detail, and then it says that they spread them out around the camp, right? That's what you do with quails. That's what the Bedouin do today when they catch quails. You put them out in the desert in the sun, and they get basically sun-dried. They become, biltong, the Amnon, like that. That's how they would do it. Now, so after this, you have this incredible appearance of the quails, and in these psukim above, it says that the anger of God was kindled in them, and he smote them with a mighty blow, and people died. Right? He was angry at them, basically, for they were complaining and so on. And people died. Now, but how did they die? Because he smote them with a mighty blow. What's going on here? So, presumably, well, according to, first of all, we want it to be something naturalistic, right? I mean, you know, the arrival of the quails was naturalistic. So, perhaps the punishment here is also something that's not miraculous, something that's within nature. And it would be especially appropriate if the punishment is somehow tied in to the sin. Now, what Abarbanel says, along with many others who studied the science of the Torah, says that what they died from is a certain poison of quails. There's a certain very mysterious and unique illness that you get from eating quails, not known to exist with eating any other creature, and it's called Caturnism, because the quail is called Caturnix. And let me give you this quote from Professor Lawrence Gravetti, who's probably the world's greatest expert in this disease. Despite several numerous accounts from classical Greece and Rome, medieval Jewish and Muslim writers, and 20th century scientists who sought to explain the intoxications, Caturnism continues to qualify as one of the longest unexplained diseases in medical history. It's a very nasty disease. It involves violent muscle pain, paralysis, renal failure, sometimes resulting in death. It seems to be something to do with what the quails eat and how it's modified in the quail's digestive system. Right? Rambam also writes about it, about how many people who eat quails get sick. Right? There's a certain disease that comes from eating quails. To match it up to what's going on in the Torah requires a little bit of fiddling. Right? It says in the Torah the meat was still between their teeth when they were struck down. So what's going on there? I mean, certainly it doesn't affect you that quickly, but it could be, Sfano explains that the idea of the meat between the teeth doesn't mean literally the meat is between the teeth, but the idea is, just like when God says he's giving them meat until it's coming out of their noses, doesn't mean it's actually going to be coming out of their nostrils. It's a figure of speech. Right? The idea of the meat being between their teeth, meaning that they were still within the month of consuming the meat. And another thing that's going on here is that Caturnism isn't often known to be fatal. There's only a few cases where it's fatal. What's interesting is that the cases where it's fatal is within people who are old or frail. And research indicates that Caturnism, this illness, is more severe if you are exerting yourself right before you eat the quail. So if that's the case, if that's what's going on here, that the more you exert yourself before you eat the quail, the more that Caturnism affects you. So which people would be the most affected by Caturnism? The people who are the greediest. Right, the people who are rushing around, they're craving the most and gathering as many quails as the most. They're the ones exerting themselves the most, so they would be the ones who would be most affected by the Caturnism, and those would be the people that die. Right, so here you have how this account, which Ramban insists should be interpreted naturalistically in order to make sense of why is Moshe saying, how can God do this? It must be something naturalistic. And with our understanding of ornithology, we can understand how this whole story, including the arrival of quails in massive numbers, the height at which they were flying, the ease of gathering them, and then the resultant plague and death for the people who are especially greedy, all fits in well. Okay, so that's it for tonight. I'm hoping that there will still be one more class next week. I'm not positive it will be, but I'm hoping it will be. And if we do have a class next week, it's going to be a really spectacular one. So don't miss it. Any questions? By the way, quails are delicious. You can eat them. I mean, quail that are served in restaurants don't ever have this poison because they're raised in farms fed regular chicken feed. It's only wild quail that carry this disease due to something that they're eating in the wild and the way in which they process it in their bodies. Saki says, where do they serve quail? Lots of gourmet restaurants serve it. I mean, I've had it at the... where have I been served quail? Let's think. David Citadel Hotel. Shalim, they serve quail. What's that restaurant in New York that serves all kinds of exotic stuff? Lamoureux? Pretty sure they serve quail. What kind of quail do people keep as pets? Often the Chinese quail, also known as button quail, which are very small and very colourful. the quail you have in America is a totally different kind. It's the bobwhite quail, I think it's called. But the European quail, also known as Coturnix quail, the quail of the Torah, you can certainly buy them in the US. So you can buy them. They'll lay eggs for you. You can eat the eggs. You know, they're very small eggs. But you can definitely buy them and eat them. I mean, talking about you can buy the bird's life quite easily. Turnix quail. If you want to do some research on them, here's how you spell it. Turnix quail. Amnon says, is there an evolutionary reason why salamanders developed this anti-fire trick? I would assume it's not. I think it's just a byproduct. In other words, I think the sometimes in evolution, you have things that didn't evolve for a certain benefit, but just as a side effect of a certain benefit. Right, salamanders have glands to produce slime so that they can respirate, produce poison, produce pheromones, and so on. It seems that the fire retardant trick might just be a side effect of those liquids. Daniel, what's your question about in Israel? Quails to eat? I'm not sure if you can buy quails to eat in Israel. You can definitely buy quails as pets, but if you can buy them to eat. Second, the Moshe should have been suspicious. You should have suspected that it would be quail. Good question. I don't know the answer to that. Any other questions? Daniel, you're typing something? Oh, you want to eat and you want to get into raisin as well? Yeah, ask around at pet stores. Sometimes pet stores can get them. Often in like, you know where you can get quails in Israel? You go to Yad Stein. Yeah. Yad2.co.il. Go to the pet section, Chayot Mechmad. Go within that to birds. And do it in the drop-down menu. Pick slab, which is quail. I have an aviary, I have all kinds of birds and iguanas and rabbits and guinea pigs and things. And I also have quail in there. Yad2.co.il, that's where you go to buy pets in Israel. I live in Ramat Beit Shemesh. Okay, leave it there. So hopefully we'll meet again next week. I just want to mention that in February, I'm going to be in the lecture tour in New York. The Shabbos, I'm going to be in Mount Vernon and in Brooklyn. On Sunday, February the, I think it's the 7th of February, or the 8th, whichever Sunday there, I'm going to be doing some Torah tours of the Bronx Zoo. I'll be posting details on my website soon. Meanwhile, if you've subscribed to my essays mailing list, you'll get details about that. I'll probably be also giving some other lectures in the New York area. So keep an eye on my Zoo Torah blog, or if you're on my mailing list, you'll find out about details of those lectures. Still have a couple of slots spare, so if you want to arrange something in your neighborhood, be in touch and we'll see if we can work something out. All right, we'll leave it there for today. Have a good night. Thank you very much for joining me. Bye-bye.